be fairly new to Piney Ridge, or maybe if today is your first time, just wanted to take a minute to introduce myself. My name is Mike Sadich, and I serve as one of the pastors here. And as you can see from the screens behind me, we are working through a study through the book of Ecclesiastes that we've entitled Fear God, Wisdom for Facing the Realities of Life. And so we're going to continue on in that series this morning. Now, around this time of the year, it's not unusual for people to resolve to do good in the coming year, to make New Year's resolutions. Now, personally, for me, I've never really been a big fan of making New Year's resolutions, not because I think there's anything necessarily wrong with them, but for me, I ask myself the question, what's the point? I mean, I make a resolution, I start off doing so good, being so disciplined, and by the second month, maybe if I'm honest, by the second week of the year, I've already let myself down. I've lost my motivation, my determination, my ambition to do that which I had resolved to do. But while I typically don't make New Year's resolutions, towards the end of last year, I did resolve to do a few things as we entered into this coming year. And that was this: to eat healthier, primarily by consuming less sugar or sweets, which, for those of you who know me, know that that I love sweets. I have a sweet tooth. Pretty passionate about the consumption of candy, of sugar, of sweets. And then lastly, I wanted to try to get back into shape, some sort of shape, in 2017. In 2016, I probably worked out about 10 hours. And so you might be thinking, well, that's pretty good. 10 hours a week, that's great. But no, what I mean is I worked out maybe a total of 10 hours or less in the entire year. So considering how often I fail to keep New Year's resolutions, it's a good thing that many of them are often to related things that are pretty superficial. So if I'm not in the best shape of my life this year, it's really not that significant in the scope of eternity, is it? I mean, 1 Timothy 4:8 says, bodily training is of some value, but godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. So while this isn't going to be a message about making New Year's resolutions, there are some resolutions that lead us towards godliness, which has value in every way, both now and forever. And so it is my hope that after hearing this message this morning, that you will resolve to do three things, specifically as we learn from Solomon through the book of Ecclesiastes. It is my hope that you will resolve to regularly search your heart, to pursue godly wisdom, and to submit to God more, not only this year, but for every year that follows. And so that's what I have entitled this message this morning. Search your heart, seek wisdom, and submit to God. And this not only serves as the title for the message, but also serves to remind us of the main points that Solomon wants us to walk away with from the verses that we'll be looking at today. And so our sermon text this morning is found in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 10, through chapter 7, verse 14. And so in honor of the reading of God's word this morning, would you please stand as we read our text? Whatever has come to be has already been named, and is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? Chapter 7, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools, and this also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. This is the reading of God's word. You may be seated. So as we look at the end of chapter 6, the chapter closes by asking two essential questions. And in asking and answering these questions, we will see that Solomon is exhorting us to search our hearts, to seek wisdom and submit to God. And the two questions that he asks at the end of chapter 6 are this: what is good for man? And who can tell man what will be after him? Or who can know the future? And so we're going to spend quite a bit of time this morning asking and answering this first question: what is good for man? And I believe that the first thing that Solomon wants us to see is that it is good for man to search his heart. At the beginning of chapter 7, we begin to see the answer to this first question. In Ecclesiastes 7:1, Solomon begins by saying that a good name is better than precious ointment. What Solomon is saying is that a good reputation, being a man of, a woman of character, of integrity, is better than precious ointment. And to help us to appreciate the contrast that Solomon is seeking to make, it's important for us to understand the significance of what precious ointment would have been worth. And so I'd invite you to look on the screens as I read from Mark chapter 14. You see, in this story, a woman comes to Jesus. She breaks an alabaster jar, fine perfume, and she anoints him with oil. Now, in this room, there are a group of religious leaders, and they begin to criticize this woman. They are infuriated. They say this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii, and this money could have been given to the poor. Now, 300 denarii would have been equivalent to 1 year's wages. I mean, imagine that. Think about that for just a minute. Working an entire year to buy this bottle of ointment. And so while precious ointment has significant monetary value, Solomon is arguing that a good reputation, a good name, has far greater worth or value. In Proverbs 22:1, Solomon says it like this: a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. Now, before I go on to the second part of verse 1, I want to put a couple of pictures up on the screen, and I want to ask the question, which one of these is better? So as you will see, the first picture is a picture of a feast, and feasts are typically reserved for times of rejoicing and celebrations, for things like weddings and graduations, for birthday parties and anniversaries, Thanksgiving meals, Christmas dinner. Now, the next picture is a picture that depicts a funeral, a place that's typically associated with great mourning and sorrow, a place where we typically spend time reflecting. So again, I ask the question, which of these is better? Now, I think it would be safe to assume that no one in this room resolved to attend more funerals in 2017 than parties or celebrations. And more than likely, the majority, if not all of you, would answer the question, which of these is better, by stating that certainly celebrations and celebrating new life is better than funerals and death. But let's see what Solomon has to say. Ecclesiastes 7:1 to verse 4. The day of death is better than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Now this probably seems pretty surprising to us, right? That the house of mourning and the day of death are better than the house of feasting and the day of birth? What is Solomon trying to get across here? Well, here is what I believe his point is. When we are celebrating life's events, when we're throwing parties, these are not typically times in our life when we are spending much, if any time at all, reflecting on our life or the condition of our heart. You see, the overall mood at partings and weddings is excitement, it's celebration, it's times of joy. But when we attend a funeral, the overall mood is most often more thoughtful, more reflective. And typically these events are coupled with us spending time evaluating our hearts and our lives. You see, at a funeral, it's not uncommon for us to be reminded of the brevity of life, that life is so short. And because of that, we find ourselves asking questions like, am I making the most of my time here on earth? What could I or what should I be doing differently? How can I redeem the time that I have left here? What needs to change in my life? Am I using my time, my energy, my resources the best way possible? And I believe that this is what Solomon is after. You see, in the first 12 verses of chapter 7, he's contrasting wisdom and folly. He's urging us in wisdom to spend time evaluating our hearts and our lives. And it is in these first four verses where he specifically is calling us to heart reflection and to introspection. And that is why Solomon can say that the house of mourning is better than the house of feasting. Because it is in the midst of tragedy, of hardship, of seasons where we're experiencing trials that we often spend the most amount of time in reflection. I mean, think over the last several years of your life, maybe your entire lifetime. When were the times that you spent the most amount of time reflecting and evaluating your heart? Evaluating your priorities, evaluating the rhythms of your life. Well, more than likely, you spent very little time if things were going well for you and your family. But when tragedy or trial struck, I would imagine that you very quickly entered into a season of reflection and evaluation. So again, this is why Solomon is saying that sorrow and mourning are better than laughter and celebration. He wants us to reflect, for that is where we grow and we're more conformed into the image of God. As I think back over my life, I know this to be true. When I was 19 years old, I had a friend that was tragically killed in an ATV accident. And it was in this season of my life that God led me to a place of deep heart reflection, introspection, where God began to expose the foolish way in which I was living, exposed my identity of walking on the path of foolishness. He began to convict me of sin and lead me on a path of righteousness. And so you may be asking yourself the question, where do I begin this process of evaluation, of heart reflection, and of introspection? Well, a good, probably even the best place to start is this process is with prayer. Praying the prayer may be similar to or the specific words that David declared in Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24, where he prays, "Search me, O God. Know my heart, try me, and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous or wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." You see, this is a prayer that is pleading with God to help one to see the true condition of their heart, to help one to identify areas of sin that have not been exposed or yet revealed. And if we fail to search and evaluate our hearts, then we will fail to seek wisdom or submit to God more. You see, we won't grow in these things because we won't see the need for them, because it is here at the place of reflection, of introspection, that we find ourselves at the starting line for growth and for change. So as you pray, as you reflect, allow the Holy Spirit to speak to you and to work in you, to allow Him to expose the sinfulness in the deep recesses of your heart and to lead you to the way everlasting. And so thus far, we've seen that Solomon defines better as a good name, and that we can relate to, that we can understand, but he also says that better is found in the house of mourning and sorrow. And again, all of these statements seem to be the exact opposite of what we would think of or what we would associate with as better. And while Solomon has been painting a contrasting picture between a funeral and a celebration to help make his point, he goes on to paint another picture in the following verses. And in this picture, he's bringing us to a crossroads. He's bringing us to a fork in the road, a place where we must decide which path we're going to take. There are two options. It's the path of wisdom, and there's the path of fools. And so far this morning, in seeking to ask and answer the question, what is good for man, we've seen that it is good for man to search his heart. And secondly, I want you to see that it is good for man to seek wisdom, to specifically seek godly wisdom. So as we look at verses 5 to 12 together, I want you to notice that there are several words that are often repeated in this section. You see, three times we see Solomon contrasting two things by using this word better. Five times he's pointing us to what is wise or what wisdom looks like. Four times he's helping us to identify what is folly or foolishness. And so Solomon here in verses 5 to 12, he's clearly contrasting wisdom and folly. And he's urging us to pursue the path of wisdom, for that path is far better. So let us look briefly at these uses of better in these verses. Three of which focus on the positive use of the term, and one that focuses on the negative. So the first time we find this word is in verse 5. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. So what Solomon is saying, instead of listening to fools who in no way help you pursue a heart of wisdom, it's better for you to receive constructive criticism from the wise. For constructive criticism corrects, it instructs, and it is here that we grow in wisdom, that the wise man imparts wisdom to us. In verse 6, Solomon gives us an illustration to help make his point. He says, for as crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools, and this also is vanity. Now this illustration serves to display the reality that thorns or small sticks ignite very quickly. They make a bunch of crackling noises and popping noises, and they go into a quick blaze. But just as quickly as they light up and produce flames, they go out, that fire dissipates. And this type of fire, Solomon says, is good for nothing. It doesn't produce any lasting heat. It doesn't provide any benefit to warm that which is in the pot. And so too are the songs of fools. Their songs are of no benefit to us or for us in seeking to gain wisdom. In verse 8a, Solomon says this, better is the end of a thing than its beginning. And again, I think the emphasis here is similar to the emphasis that Solomon had in the first four verses. When something ends, we typically tend to look back and to evaluate, don't we? We look at how things could have been better, how we can improve things the next time. And here again, Solomon is drawing our attention to seasons of life when we tend to be more reflective. He's saying that these seasons are better. These things are better for us. Verse 8b, the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit, or the spirit that is patient is better than the prideful or proud spirit. Why? Well, there are many scriptures in the Old and New Testament that could help us to answer this question, but I want to draw our attention to two this morning. First one found in James 4:6, God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. So why is it better to have a patient spirit than a proud spirit? Because God, he is opposed to the proud. In Matthew 23:12, it says, whoever exalts himself will be humbled. But whoever humbles himself will be exalted. And that brings us to verse 10. And it is here that we see this word better actually used in a negative sense. Solomon writes, say not, or do not say, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. In other words, it's not good for us to look on or dwell on the good old days or the glory days. And I can't count how many times I've heard people make statements similar to this. If we could just go back to the time when America was a Christian nation living on good Christian moral principles, everything would just be better. Everything would be okay. But the reality is this. Restoring America to good moral principles doesn't fix the problem. You see, the problem with America is the problem of every nation. And that is a sin problem that is deeply rooted in the heart of men and women and children. And reflecting on the good old days when America was more moral doesn't do us any good because it doesn't change anything. What has been done has already been named, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 6:10. And that is what Solomon is trying to get across. It is foolish. It's a waste of time for us to spend our time dwelling on that which once was. Now, outside of seeing what is better, according to Solomon, Solomon is also contrasting wise from foolish living throughout verses 5 to 12. And let's look at a couple of these things this morning. Verse 7, oppression drives the wise to madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. In these verses, it's speaking to the reality that the pressure the wise man is faced with when he is being oppressed. You see, the second part of the verse describes for us how the man may be made mad, in a sense, by pursuing the folly of accepting or making a bribe. You see, he so badly wants to avoid being oppressed that he makes the foolish decision of entering into a bribe. And this bribe corrupts his heart. And so Solomon is helping us to see the folly in this decisioning. Verse 9. That we should not be quick to become angry, for that is a characteristic of the fool. James 1:19 says, everyone should be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. This is both wise. This is actually evidence of godly living, of godly character. And so this path of wisdom, although it's the harder path to travel than the path of fools, is the right path to travel. Solomon is helping us to see that wise living has far greater benefits than foolish living. Very simply, wise living is better than foolish living. This now brings us to verses 11 and 12. And these verses speak to wisdom and wealth. And according to many commentators, verse 11a would better be translated, wisdom with an inheritance is good, an advantage to those who see the sun, for or because the protection of money is like the protection is like the protection of money. And the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. So what is Solomon trying to say here? He's saying that both wisdom and money are beneficial in the sense that they both provide protection. See, if you have money saved up and an unexpected expense comes up, it doesn't cripple you, it doesn't paralyze you, it doesn't usher you into the state of anxiety and panic because you have the resources saved up to meet the expense. And so too, if you have wisdom, it provides protection by giving what you need to navigate through the difficult seasons of life. And Solomon says this type of wisdom actually serves to preserve you. And so Solomon rightly concludes that the value of wisdom is greater than the value of money. And so by way of a reminder of where we started this morning, I stated that these 12 verses in Ecclesiastes 7 had helped us to answer the question, what is good for man? And so very simply, we could succinctly summarize and apply these first 12 verses by stating that it is good for man to spend time reflecting on their lives and their hearts, evaluating their heart. And it is good for us, it is good for man to pursue the path of wisdom and avoid the path
of folly.
But is that all that Solomon is trying to teach us through these verses? I don't think so. You see, his final application, his final exhortation comes to us in verses 13 and 14. And I believe that this is the climax of what Solomon wants us to learn from these verses. You see, he's seeking to answer the second question that was presented at the end of chapter 6. Who can tell man what will be after him? Or who can know the future? And in answering this question, I believe that Solomon wants us to lead us to the conclusion that it is best for us to submit to God. Allow me to explain for a few minutes. Ecclesiastes 7, verses 13 and 14. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Now, the main idea in these verses is that what God has done will be, that we cannot thwart, we cannot alter his plans. He will accomplish all of his plans, all his purposes. We cannot change what God has done or what God will do. And he is the only one who knows the future. So who can tell man what will be after him? Only God can. And so in the days of prosperity, be joyful. And in the days of adversity, know that both are works of God. And since we don't know what the future holds, since you or I do not know what the future holds, the only logical conclusion, the only application for us is this, that we should fully submit to and fully trust the one who does hold the future. We should fully submit to, we should fully trust the one who does hold the future. And that is what I believe Solomon wants us to walk away with from these verses. In studying to prepare for the sermon, I came across one commentator who says this about these two verses. On the good days, be happy. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. On the bad days, look to God and look at what God does. Consider the work of God. Trust in the Lord's sovereign purposes, knowing that he once used the worst day in human history, the day of Christ's crucifixion, to bring hope and happiness to the world forever. And because we know that God is in the business of redeeming and restoring that which is broken, we can, in faith and confidence, boldly and fully submit to him, because we know of his goodness. We know of his grace. It is reserved for those who are his, for those who submit to him. As I read these last two verses and considered that we cannot make straight what God has made crooked, and as I consider the goodness and the faithfulness of God, this God to whom we should submit to because he proves to be faithful and good, it brought to my mind the story of a man named Joseph. It's found in the book of Genesis. As many of you will remember, Joseph was one of the sons of a man named Jacob, one of many sons, and not only one of the sons, but the favored son of his father Jacob. And because of this, Joseph's brothers, they grow jealous of him. They hate him. And to make matters worse, Joseph has a dream that God helps him to understand and to interpret, and he goes and tells his brother what this dream was and what it meant. And the dream was this, that one day his brothers are going to bow down to him. And so as you can imagine, this only fuels the brothers' hatred for Joseph, so much so that they want to kill Joseph. They make plans to murder him. But one of the brothers, he comes up with an alternative plan. Judah, he says, you see these Midianite traders that are coming towards us from the distance? Why don't we sell Joseph as a slave? At least then we'll have some profit from his life. And so that's exactly what they do. They sell Joseph to these Midianite traders who take him to Egypt, and they sell him as a slave to a man named Potiphar. Now, because of Joseph's wisdom, he quickly finds favor with Potiphar, so much that Potiphar gives him kind of rule over his entire household. That is until Potiphar's wife, who wanted to enter into an adulterous relationship with Joseph, falsely accuses him of trying to rape her. You see, time and time again, she tried to convince Joseph to sleep with her, and time again, he rejected her. Until one day, he enters the room where she grabs him by the robe, and he runs out of the room, leaving his robe in her hands, and she begins to scream, saying, "This man Joseph, he's trying to rape me." Now, as you can imagine, Potiphar, because of this, he's not too happy with Joseph, and so he throws him into prison. And it is in this prison where Joseph is accompanied by two men, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. And both of these men go on to have dreams, and Joseph, by the wisdom of God, has the ability to rightly interpret these dreams. You see, the dreams were this, that the baker in 3 days was going to be killed. But the chief cupbearer was going to be restored to his place of service with the king. And so Joseph asked the cupbearer, "Please remember me when you go before Pharaoh so that I can get out of this prison." But the cupbearer forgets about Joseph, and Joseph remains in prison for 2 more years. That is until Pharaoh has a dream that no one in his kingdom can interpret. And it is then that his cupbearer is reminded of this man named Joseph who's in prison, that God has given the ability to interpret dreams. And so Pharaoh calls for Joseph and he tells him his dream. And Joseph does, in fact, rightly interpret Pharaoh's dream. And the dreams meant this. There are going to be 7 years of plenty that are going to be followed by 7 years of famine. So they needed to stockpile, they needed to store food in these seasons of plenty to see them through these seasons where there would be a famine in the land. So that's exactly what happens, and that's exactly what Egypt does. They stockpile the food. And so when the famine, in fact, hits in Egypt and in the surrounding lands, Jacob, Joseph's father, and his brothers find themselves with no food. And so Jacob sends his sons, 10 of his sons, to Egypt. And this is the first time that Joseph and his brothers are met face to face since they had sold him as a slave. So at this point, many years had passed, and Joseph's brothers don't recognize him, but Joseph almost immediately recognizes his brothers. Now, to make a long story short, Joseph, he extends forgiveness to his brothers. He quickly offers them the food that they will need. And he invites them to come live in a land near Egypt so that they could be provided for through this famine. So all the while, as this is happening, God is working. He's working to preserve this line of Jacob, this line through whom the Messiah, the promised Messiah, was one day going to come. So in this story, Joseph is plotted to be murdered by his brothers. He's then sold as a slave, where he finds favor with Potiphar until he's falsely accused of trying to rape Potiphar's wife. Then he rightly interprets dreams. He asks this cupbearer to remember him, but he forgets him. Joseph spends 2 more years in prison until he finds favor with Pharaoh. And all the while, God was working to preserve and to provide for his people. We see him redeeming the sinful intentions of men, of Joseph's brothers, and working them for good, both for Joseph's good and for the good of the nation of Israel. Not only for the good of the nation of Israel, but for our good. By preserving this family line, the Messiah did in fact come. And so this story, maybe better than any other story, is one of those where we see that God is always working, even in the midst of adversity. I mean, imagine all of the adversity that Joseph faced, but God was working for the good of his people to accomplish his will. Because of this, we should heed the wisdom of Solomon to submit to and to trust this good, this gracious, this all-knowing God, so that in seasons of prosperity or in seasons of adversity, we can boldly and with confidence declare, "It is well with my soul. It is well with my soul because I've submitted my life to Christ. It is well with my soul because in Christ I've received all of the blessings and benefits that he has purchase for me. It is well with my soul because I know that God is working all things, even things that I don't understand, and even in ways that I might not often like, He's working all things out for my good. So in response to all that you've heard this morning, I would encourage you to apply the wisdom that Solomon is seeking to impart to us, to regularly search your heart, to seek godly wisdom, and to submit to God.